welcome to season 4 of the Hennessy Box Podcast. Here are your hosts.
Hi, I'm Brad Churchwell.
And I'm Farhan Ghalani.
And I'm Jimmy Deep. We are the broker owners of RE/MAX iRealty Innovations.
Just because they want to know, like, if your house,
right,
your house, not your freaking deck or a fence that your neighbor built, whatever, if your house is sitting 2 feet onto the neighbor's land,
that's true,
or 3 feet onto utility right of way,
yeah,
it's a possibility that house might have to be.
Hey, everybody, welcome to season 4 of the Hennessy Box Podcast. I think we're on episode 3. You know, I'm going to start announcing them again.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing.
Episode 3.
Episode 3. And today we have Mr. Richard Horn from Airdrie Lawyers, one of our trusted lawyers that we work with all the time, really. And he's my go-to guy. So he's here to talk to us about everything legal.
Yeah.
All right.
Related.
So do you prefer Richard or Rick?
You could call me Rick.
Ah, thanks.
Now, this is the Hennessy
Box Podcast.
So where's the Hennessy? I
don't see it. We drank it all. That's why we only have the boxes left.
You know what? Here, I'll give you a little background story on this one. We call it the Hennessy Box Podcast because when we first started, we didn't have any mic stands because this was during COVID. And we're like, hey, let's start a podcast like everybody else did. Like everybody and their dogs started podcasts, casting during that time. And all we had was an empty Hennessy box that we cut some holes in and we used it as a microphone stand. Oh, cool. So we called it a Hennessy Box Podcast. And on season 1, which is just absolutely wild, we were actually drinking Hennessy.
Yeah, there was a lot of Hennessy
during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And we have since moved away from that. But we've kept the name. We can have some later, Rick.
All right.
Hey, you want to give us a little intro about yourself?
Well, my name is Rick Horn. I have a small law firm in Airdrie. It's called Airdrie Lawyers. We specialize in real estate and commercial corporate matters and wills and estates. We've got another lawyer that does like litigation when we need that. And I've got another lawyer coming starting next month, and she's going to be doing more general practice as well.
Oh, nice. Real estate's the bulk of your stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. Sweet. Okay. You know what? I want to start this off. We have, as agents, as brokerages, right? We do the selling, the brokering, you know, finding the house, putting the contracts together. We do our very best to try to term a lot of different things into the contract for different situations, right? But lawyers don't see any of that until it's a firm deal. And we've been given the name of the lawyer that the buyer or the seller is going to use. And the listing agent, the listing brokerage then sends out conveyancing, all the documents to both lawyers, buyers and sellers. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what happens when you get that package in your inbox?
Well, first of all, we don't usually open the file until we get the conveyancing package.
Yeah.
Because people will call us and tell them they're buying or selling, and then it doesn't, you know, conditions aren't waived or whatever. So we usually don't even open the file until we receive something from the listing lawyer's office. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you mentioned is, you know, it's a firm deal and all. So that's something you need to remember. Once the lawyer gets the file, like the conveyancing package from the listing lawyer's office, it's a firm deal. Like we can't change the contract. All we can do is close the deal.
Right. Okay. I want to back this up a little bit. You're talking about receiving the conveyancing package from the listing lawyer's office.
Yeah.
If you were on the buyer side, what is that a different conveyancing package you're talking about, or is that the same one that we send out?
Yeah, your conveyancing office will send something to both lawyers, the buyer's lawyer and the seller's lawyer.
Oh, okay. You're talking about the listing brokerage. Sorry.
Listing brokerage, yeah.
So the listing brokerage will send out the contract
to both
the buyer and the seller's lawyer.
Yep.
And when we get that, whether we're acting for the buyer or the seller, we don't usually open the file until we get that.
Got it.
And then, you know, just as I was mentioning, you know, at that time, sometimes people want us to change the deal. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it happens, if you see that very often, but we do. And the answer is, well, we can't. I mean, it's a deal.
Right.
We're now here. We are here to just make sure that you, as a buyer, get what you bargained to get. And as a seller, you get what you bargained to receive.
Right. So like a lot of times things happen after you guys get the documentation. And you know, some agents I find is like, yeah, I mean, we'll just leave the lawyers to deal with
that. Yeah, that's,
you know,
at this stage, it's in the lawyer's hands.
Yeah, at this stage, it's in the lawyer's hands. Like, you know, some things I think are yes, it's definitely up to the law firms to handle. But what about like amending dates, like possession dates and adding terms of what's included and what's not included? I mean,
issue comes up, we will sometimes just deal with it ourselves,
right?
Between the lawyers' offices, it's sometimes easier for us to deal. As a general rule, though, we like the realtors to make amendments to the contract because you're the one that wrote it in the first place. We'd prefer that if you made the amendments,
right?
You know, we real estate lawyers, we depend on realtors. You know,
right.
We get a lot of our work referred to us for realtors, so we always try to be kind to realtors. But sometimes we secretly hate you, right? Because
see that.
There is some, you know, with some, and I'm not trying to like paint a lot of realtors with a bad brush, but you know, there, we do see sometimes where it's like, you know what, just get it signed. Let the lawyers, you know, we haven't resolved these issues. We'll just let the lawyers deal with it.
Right. Right.
You
right.
know, like, and that can be frustrating, but you know, if you're you're doing your job and you're dealing with issues as they come up, then it's not usually, we'll usually deal with anything else. It's just, you have to remember, you know, you guys can do a lot of work, but you make a lot of money, right? You're going to make a commission. You know, you're going to share like 20 grand sometimes or whatever.
Yeah.
The lawyer's making about $600, right? He doesn't want to spend 3 hours on this file. So the more you can do to just simplify life for your lawyers, the happier they're going to be. You know, and sometimes we get frustrated.
That's right.
But, you know, we don't usually complain about it because we want you to keep sending us work.
Thank you very much. You're getting the raw and dirty from Rick here today, right?
I love the honesty.
But when something has to be changed, sometimes there is a necessity. Something comes up, but we got to deal with it. And we usually just will. Gotcha. You have to remember that, you know, on most deals, because we don't get paid a lot per deal, that our assistants do most of the work.
Right.
So you might have like 15 deals go really smooth. It's that one bad one that you spend all your day on.
Right, right.
Right. And so, you know, it averages out.
Right. Right? Yeah. You don't want to be that one bad deal.
Yeah.
So on the closing day, so like, you know, you prep all the paperwork, client comes in, you sign the documents with them. Okay. Well, what happens on closing day? Like what happens right before we get that phone call from the lawyer saying keys are releasable?
Well, yeah, let's back up a little bit and let's just deal with the seller. If we're acting for the seller, okay. So what happens is we will do all the searches, make sure the taxes are up to date, or we know what the taxes are. We're going to check the title and see what mortgages have to be paid out, and see if there's any other encumbrances that are going to be an issue. Trying to anticipate the concerns that the buyer's lawyer is going to have. Okay. So we do that. We prepare a transfer of land, and then we have the client, we'll call up the client, and hopefully we can do that a week or so in advance.
Mm-hmm.
We'll call up the sellers, have them come into the office. They're going to sign the transfer.
That timeline usually is a week. I find about a week, but is there a reason for that? Like, is it the closer the better? Is it like, you know, does it matter if you sign it 4 weeks in advance?
Optimal time is probably about 10 days before the closing date. And the reason for that is banks, like we have to order, one of the things we do is we order a payout statement. We're going to check the title and we're going to see, hey, there's a CIBC mortgage on here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then we have to get the mortgage reference number from the client. So we got to get some information from the client. We get the mortgage reference number. We order the payout statement. As a general rule, a bank will not send you a payout statement earlier than 10 days prior to closing. So sometimes we're just spinning our wheels and doing the same job twice if we meet a client too early.
Right.
Right.
Makes sense.
And also, there's some other things that come up on the buyer side. I'll get to that in a minute. But for the most part, we like to meet them about 10 days to a week prior to closing. We'll have them sign the transfer. We prepare a statement of adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
And the statement of adjustments is going to be sent to the buyer's lawyer telling them how much money they got to give us. So that's where we show adjustments for like, there was a $10,000 deposit paid.
Right.
There is an adjustment for property taxes because the taxes are either being paid monthly or they've been paid in June, or, you know, we have to deal with that. There's condo fees.
Right.
Sometimes there's homeowners association fees. So we have to order all that information. We have to find out, what are the condo fees? Have they been paid this much? Are there any special assessments owing? And make sure, like, so there's a lot of work before we ever see the client. But when we see the client, they sign the transfer. And then once the transfer is signed, we will prepare what we call a trust letter. Now, the trust letter is the magic on how the whole deal works.
Okay.
All right. And that trust letter gets sent over to the buyer's lawyer. The buyer's lawyer will review the trust letter, make sure that everything is in good stead, and then they will prepare their stuff. So let me tell you about the trust letter for a minute.
Yeah.
The trust letter is the grease that makes the engine run. Okay. It's not the power, but if you don't have trust letters, that is the problem. You have to, like, in Alberta, you have to have this situation. So when we do a transfer in Alberta, you can't transfer land. And you guys know this, but you can't transfer land without having go through the land titles office.
Right.
Okay. Land titles is slow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Land titles a few months ago was taking 4 months
to
register a document.
That was ridiculous.
Yeah. They've caught up now. They're about 3 weeks. So that's not too bad for Alberta. They've been catching up. But there's a 3-week delay.
Mm-hmm.
So it creates a chicken and egg problem.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you can get this date on the land title website.
Yep.
Right, top right hand corner.
What date they're working
on. Hot tip, top right hand corner, spin
pew,
two.
Pew, pew.
Yeah.
There's a date. We are processing.
Say maybe January 2nd.
Something
today.
And a date that'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
hot tip.
What happens is somebody has to go first.
Right.
Right. You can't close a real estate transaction like you would close a car purchase. You know, when you buy a car, you go into the dealership, you got a bank draft for like 60 grand. You come in there, they give you the bill of sale.
Right.
You give them the bank draft. They give you the keys. You walk out there, you insure it, and you're on your way.
Right.
Okay. You can't buy a house like that. There's this big delay. So the seller doesn't want to give up title until they get the money.
Yeah.
The buyer, he doesn't want to give up the money until he gets the title.
Right.
But you can't just pass it across the table.
Yeah, you got to delay.
Somebody's got to go first. And in addition to that, the buyer's mortgage company is not going to give up and release money until they know they have a good title and that they're secured.
Okay.
So somebody's got to go first. And in what we do in Alberta is the seller goes first. The seller's lawyer will prepare the transfer and he will send it over to the buyer's lawyer with the trust letter. And the trust letter has what we call trust conditions and undertakings. So those are basically promises between lawyers. And it's those promises between the lawyers that lets the transaction happen.
Right.
The seller's lawyer says, listen, here's your transfer. You can use it, but you can only use it if you promise me that you will send it into the land titles office together with your client's mortgage.
Right.
And that you will request the funds for your client's mortgage. And when you receive those funds, you will send them to us.
Wait, so you actually, when you're talking about banks funding a mortgage, they don't actually give you the money before possession day?
They send us the money on possession.
On possession.
The morning. But that's they don't want us to release it unless we can tell them that they are going to have good security. So for them to have good security, the title has to be in the borrower's name.
Right.
And they have to have the mortgage registered. And
right.
They want to make sure there's no other prior financial encumbrances on that title.
Mm-hmm. And you have to say pretty please, I think.
But we can't do that on closing day.
Okay, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how we used to do it is we would always want to meet with the client really early, like 10 days before. We would get everything together and we would send it in. We would send the transfer of land to the land titles office with the buyer's lawyer would send the transfer of land that he'd received from the seller's lawyer and send that together with the mortgage to land titles. And they would do that like 10 days before closing.
Okay, yeah.
All right. And they would wait for it to come back.
Right.
And when it came back, they would check the title and they would see, okay, our clients, the buyers are on title.
Right.
The mortgage is registered. Now, the seller's mortgage is still on there.
Right.
And it's going to take a few months to get that removed.
Right.
So they will get, they're sending the, they're going to get an undertaking from the seller's lawyer. That's in the trust letter.
Right.
And that will say, listen, when you give me the money, when I, as a seller's lawyer, receive the money from you, I will take that money and I will use it to make sure I pay off my client's mortgage.
Right.
And then I will request a mortgage discharge. And so that I will undertake to provide you with a clear title. Now, I probably won't get that to you for like 3 months.
Right.
But I will undertake to do that. And I will undertake to make sure that anything else that's registered on title that's not supposed to be there, mm-hmm. that I will discharge it. If the taxes are in arrears, I will pay the tax arrears. If the condo fees have to, you know, I will do all that.
Right.
So that's in that trust letter that the seller's lawyer sends to the buyer's lawyer. He is saying, you can't use this unless you do this, one, two, three.
Right.
And in return, I will promise to use your money to discharge these things.
Right. Okay.
So it used to be that we would, when I started practicing 30 years ago, 32 years ago now, we would try to do that all before the closing date. And then on the closing date, we would have the title, we would see the mortgages on there, and then we would fund the loan.
Right.
Okay.
That's when it didn't take 3 weeks
That's or when
4 months.
They only took a week. They took 5 days to do it, right? 4 days. And so we could do that. And then land titles got slower and slower and slower. And if you remember, if you were doing this like 20 years ago, you may remember that on the closing date, we still don't have the money yet.
Right.
Because we don't have title in our client's name yet. We're still waiting for land titles to transfer the title. So the bank's not going to fund the loan. So then we have to arrange to do a tenancy at will agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And so the buyers would move into the property on the closing date, but they haven't paid for it yet because we're still waiting on land titles.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're waiting and waiting, waiting. Sometimes we'd have to, the buyers would move in and lease the property for like 3-4 weeks until finally we get that transfer.
Mm-hmm.
We get that title back and show, oh, the mortgage is registered. Now the bank will fund the loan.
Right.
It was just a headache.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened was these title insurance companies that have been working for years and years down in the U.S., they started coming up into Canada.
Okay.
And they said, listen, what we'll do is we'll insure you for that time delay. If you send your transfer of land into land titles and there's going to be a 3-week delay.
Right.
The risk is that some creditor of the seller
will register something.
Registers a caveat or a writ or, you know, whatever, any kind of encumbrance on the title, and you get stuck with that.
Right.
Right. So what they would say to us, what they say to us is like, all right, tell you what, if you buy this title insurance policy, we will insure you for that risk. So if you pay for the property today, take possession of the property today, and you can fund your loan, we will insure you and we will insure your bank against the risk that for the next 3 weeks, while it's still in the seller's name, if anything gets registered on there, we'll clear it off and we'll make sure everyone's good.
Okay.
Okay. That's why we buy title insurance.
Okay.
Okay. Now, title insurance also has some other benefits because they insure you for things like mortgage fraud and title fraud. They'll insure you for losses as a result of things being on the property that weren't done permitted properly, or that, you know, your deck is too big, your fence is in the wrong spot. And that's why we'll sometimes use it to replace a real property.
So does that, but so does that go indefinitely? If, like, let's say for the deck in the wrong spot. Okay.
It goes for anything that existed on the property at the time that you bought it.
Okay. Okay.
So if you bought the property and then built a new deck, you're not insured for that.
Right.
But if you bought the property with the existing deck and you didn't know it was a problem,
right,
then title insurance will cover you for that. And they cover you for things like mortgage fraud. Somebody gets your identification, they pose as you, they take out a loan on your property.
Right.
The first you ever hear about it is when they're serving you with a statement of claim because they never got repaid.
Right.
So they'll, you know, you hear these companies that advertise, you own your own home, you know, oh, you're approved for a loan.
Right, right, right.
Because if you, you know, someone, if you paid off your loan, your mortgage, you have no mortgage on the property, you can get a mortgage,
loan pretty easily.
A loan pretty easy. And they don't do much checking on your income or anything. So,
right.
you know, so you could be subject to some fraud there. Now, having said that, those things rarely happen, at least here.
Right.
Like, it doesn't happen very often. In 30 years, I think I've made one title insurance claim, right? So it's more, you know, fraud takes place a little bit more often, I think, out in BC because you have people buying property sight unseen and that sort of thing. But, you know, it's good to have that title insurance, but it's...
Who pays for that title insurance?
The buyer.
The buyer usually pays for it?
Yeah.
Can the seller pay for it? I've seen deals where they say, you know what, we'll close it this way, but the seller's got to pay for this insurance.
Yeah, so the contracts in Alberta all say that you have to provide, the seller has to provide a real property report.
Right.
Okay. Sometimes people don't have them, or they're not up to date, and sometimes they'll negotiate. They'll say, listen, we're not going to provide you with a real property report, but we'll pay for your title insurance. So if a problem does occur, you've got insurance.
Right.
Now that's always open to you to do that. I mean, it's better to know whether there's a problem by having the real property report than just say, well, if there is, you have insurance.
Right.
Right.
So,
but it's still an option.
If it replaces that, the thing is the title insurance is like a few hundred bucks on average.
It averages from $175 to $250 for most residential homes.
So if you took that title insurance, here's my issue with the title insurance scenario. You pay for the say $300, $275, $300 or whatever, right? And you don't get an RPR. But it costs like $800 to get an RPR drawn.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're in the hole.
And then another $150 or so to get it.
To get stamped or whatever.
Compliance.
So,
and sorry, can I just jump in? Because I think something that agents are often confused about is, you know, you say you're covered, you're insured for that deck that's too big and you didn't know. What exactly does that mean? Like you're insured for a full replacement of that deck so it is compliant?
So if you have a deck, let's say... And the city doesn't usually get too out of joint if you have
relaxation. Right?
Yeah, they'll sometimes give you relaxation, that sort of thing. But if the deck is high, it's, you know, those ones, you know, where a walkout basement and the deck on the main floor is quite high, that's where they're a little more strict. And so if your deck is pretty high, they don't want it going out too far because they feel like it's an invasion of privacy of your neighbor. You're looking down on your neighbor.
Sure.
Right? So it could be decks. It could be, you know, a planter that you've put out and it goes into the, you know, out into the back lane. People are really bad about always be suspicious or be careful when they've built their own garage in the back.
Yeah.
Right? that is accessed from a lane.
Mm-hmm.
That is very common that those things are encroaching into the lane. People forget that you have to look at, you know, not just your where your walls are, but where the foundation is on the ground and also the eaves. The eaves usually overhang, you know, about another 8 inches or so, right? And oftentimes those are encroaching onto the city. Now, the city might give you an encroachment agreement, but that's a $500 pop right there, plus your other legal expenses. So,
Going back to the question, if the deck was too high or too low or whatever, too protruding, and...
They'll probably just make you cut it back.
And the insurance would pay for that.
Yeah.
They'll pay for the fix of it.
They'll pay to fix that and they'll cover your loss. Now, that's your financial loss. But now you can't stretch out on your deck like you used to. You can't fit the barbecue there like you used to.
Yeah.
Right? And what are they going to pay you for that? Like,
It's an interesting thing because, again, I think agents don't... for the most part, don't understand what it fully means, title insurance, but it's something that we're seeing more and more of. Sellers are in a position where they can say, you know what, I'm just not going to update my RPR.
In this market?
It's really a negotiable thing. Yeah. I mean, it's in the contract. It's a standard clause in the area contract, but there's no reason why you can't scratch it out.
And we're seeing a lot of it.
So, are you seeing more and more RPRs not being provided?
No, I think it's always been pretty.
And what's your preference? RPR? No?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if I'm acting for the buyer,
you're going to want it.
I would rather know if there's an issue, let's know about it now and deal with it now.
Yeah.
Than find out, you know, 5 years from now. Or like it's usually you find out when you sell the property.
Yeah.
Because you have after, there's nobody policing these things.
Right.
You can build yourself a big gazebo in the backyard and a pergola and all sorts of planters here and there. And unless your neighbors complain,
Nobody's policing.
Nobody knows about it. Nobody's going to complain. The city doesn't come around and check those things. It's not until you submit a real property report to the city for a compliance certificate that that it becomes an issue. Now, having said that, you know, if it were up to me, I'd get rid of the things.
Get rid of the what?
Get rid of the RPR. The RPR? Take it out of the contract. Why do you need it? Right?
Well, didn't we just talk about that we need to know that everything is like in place?
But ignorance is bliss. What if you never know? You probably never know, right? Because yeah,
pretty good legal advice.
The main problem is, when they started with RPRs,
right?
Go back decades. When they started, say, hey, let's put this in the contract, is because they want to know, like, if your house,
right,
your house, not your freaking deck or a fence that your neighbor built, whatever. Yeah. If your house is sitting 2 feet onto the neighbor's land,
that's true,
or 3 feet onto utility right of way,
yeah.
It's a possibility that house might have to be demolished or moved, which at what expense? But I can tell you, it is a practical thing. I've been doing this for 32 years. I have never seen it myself. I have never seen anyone having to move a garage or move a house or tear it down. Never.
Right.
So that's where I would say, okay, let's ensure the really important thing. The banks wanted to know that the house didn't have to move. The banks didn't really care
about the shed.
The shed or the deck.
The hot tub.
Or the hot tub. They didn't care. It's the house. But now that we have to do this and now these things, now the city, I'll tell you why we still have it in my opinion, which it's not a legal opinion.
Money grab.
Yes. The surveyors are making a fortune off this stuff, and the city makes a fortune.
Sure.
And so if you said, hey, you don't need RPRs, like they don't require them in every jurisdiction.
I think we still need them.
Like in BC, if you want an RPR, you're a buyer, you get it yourself. The seller doesn't provide it.
Interesting. Right?
So
it's gotten out of hand, actually.
It has.
Every year, you're going to say every year something changed. They change their rules every year.
It's like, AC.
Air conditioners. Can't have them on the side.
Why? And then window wells and hot tubs. And now you got to draw patios over, it just keeps on going.
So the surveyors put that in there, and then you got to take it to the city, and you're going to show them, this is what we did. And the cities go, well, we don't like that. You're supposed to be a meter away,
or whatever.
But you're encroaching like 10 centimeters.
But pay me some money and we'll make it all right.
Here's the other thing.
That's not what it was originally intended for. It was originally intended to make sure your house is not sitting on your neighbor's land.
I would agree with that because, the relaxation doesn't make any sense, right? If it was truly a hazard or it was truly an access issue, if your air conditioner was sitting between your house and the other house and it was like a hazardous thing, right? Then that should be corrected. And you shouldn't be able to be like, here's $300. Give me a relaxation for it. Because the problem still exists.
Like if it's a fire risk or something.
Yeah, if it's like a fire risk or whatever, right? Or if the deck is too... the thing is, if the deck is too far out, you can get a relaxation on that deck. And then it becomes a non-problem.
Okay, let's look at something like an encroachment agreement. Okay, so you've got your planters encroaching onto the city's land, right? Or you've got your garage, encroaching onto that back lane, which we see a fair amount. Okay, so you can go get an encroachment agreement. So the city will take your $500 and say, okay, you don't have to tear it down now, but we can tear it down whenever we say.
Or you do anything to your garage, you got to take it down.
What are you paying for? You're signing an agreement that says, okay, I don't have to tear it down now, but I do if you ever tell me in the future.
Yeah.
What is that?
I decide to do something with it, you're going to have to fix it, right? If you touch the garage, you're going to have to bring it back in compliance. I think that's the other part of
if you ever renovate or rebuild, you have to rebuild within compliance.
Right.
Right. So, I could go on forever about RPRs. I think we should just get rid of the damn things. But having said that, that's one of the things that, the seller's lawyer is going to look at. Then he sends it over to the buyer's lawyer. Now, when the buyer's lawyer gets all those documents, he then is going to call in his client to sign the mortgage.
So you need the documents from the seller's lawyer before the buyer's lawyer or the buyers can actually come in and sign the documents.
Well, we need them before we can close the deal, but we will often, if I'm acting for the buyer, I might not have received the seller's documents yet.
Okay.
And I like to have the seller's documents because I want that statement of adjustments.
Right.
That statement of adjustments tells me what's been paid as deposit, yeah. what the adjustments are for taxes and condo fees and that sort of thing. And then I can tell, see, then what happens is when I have that and as a buyer's lawyer, I have to wait for the mortgage instructions.
Right.
So what happens is the buyer will tell his bank, you know, I'm using this lawyer. That bank will usually email instructions to the lawyer's office. And then we use those instructions to prepare the mortgage. And then we get that mortgage prepared. We know how much the bank's going to send us. Because if you borrow $300,000, that doesn't mean I'm going to get $300,000.
Right.
Because they may take off some fees here and there and this and that. And mm-hmm. they may, you know, there's things like, you know.
That's why the buyer has to bring in such an odd number
yeah.
of a draft at the mm-hmm. end.
There. Yeah. So what we do is we take the number from the statement of adjustments.
Right.
Then we know how much money we need to send to the seller's lawyer. And then from that, we will figure out, okay, well, we know how much we have to send them. How much are we getting from the loan? And then how much are we adding that we need for like our legal account mm-hmm. and all, you know, things like that. So we like to know that because then when we tell the client to come in, we say, well, okay, well, I need a bank draft for $57,328.16.
Yeah. yeah.
Right. So they don't have to bring that money in later. So we like to have that. But when they come Makes in, sense. we show them that statement of adjustments. We show them how much money they need and why they had to bring in that exact amount of money. And then we have them sign the mortgage. And then once the mortgage is signed, we then will send a report, an interim report to the lender with a request for funds. Okay. And we say, here, with the mortgage is signed, we've checked their ID, everything's good. Please send us these funds. And we will have the money arrive in our office the morning of closing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So usually around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, we're going to get confirmation the money's in our account. That gives us about an hour to get it turned around and sent over to the seller's lawyer. The seller's lawyer wants that money by noon.
Right.
Right. And if we don't get it by noon, we'll have to pay interest to the next day.
Okay.
So we have about an hour, hour and a half. So the morning that we're acting for a buyer on a purchase, it's a very busy morning because we got to get the money and then we got to get it turned around and we got to get it into the bank and deposited into the account of the seller's lawyer. That's fine if you got one deal, but if you got like 12 deals, you got to do that for like 12 different files and you have to get it done by noon.
So there's delays on EFTs and there's delays on like... Mm-hmm. the electronic stuff. So I'm assuming that you got somebody running to banks to do
exactly,
this.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's
physically run
have to go
bank.
To the bank.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. It's old school.
It yeah. is.
Well, because you can't EFT.
That's why you always look frazzled.
It takes like 24 hours.
Yeah, because you can't that's guarantee
that's
when
why
the money's
lawyers are always so frazzled near yeah. the end of the month or beginning.
So you literally have to take the check to the branch. So now let's say you got like 5 or 6 deals. So I got to run for Jimmy's sale. I got to run over to it's TD Bank. And for this other one, I got to run to Scotia. And then I got to run to ADP. So we might have to run to 5 different financial institutions,
right.
make all these deposits, email the receipt
the slips. Yeah.
to the seller's lawyer. And that all has to be done by noon.
That's fucking wild.
Right?
Yeah, actually.
So it can be a very, very hectic there's morning.
Uber
so,
delivery.
Now, so, if you're right. acting for the seller... Okay, you're getting all that money at noon. So
right.
when you come back from lunch,
yeah.
you have the money in your account and then you use the afternoon to pay off the mortgage for
right.
your client, to pay their realtor.
Right.
We like to make sure the realtors always get paid quickly.
Very important.
Right? And then pay, you know, anything else that we
right,
agreed
right, right.
to pay. And then write a check to ourselves for our account and then the balance to our client.
Right. So that noon time.
That's all done in the afternoon.
So that noon time on the contract is... That's tight.
It is.
Loose, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the possession to be given by noon.
Yep. That's, Some, that's sometimes tight. You know, you'll ask clients or you'll ask the other lawyer, so can you give us an extension? Let's give us till 1 o'clock. And you know what? My personal policy is, listen, if you get me the money in time that I can pay out my client's
right.
mortgage and everything, mm-hmm. then yeah, you can have an extension. But not everybody gives extensions.
So do you guys
Especially
have like
if
a...
really busy. They want it by noon because they got things yeah, to do in the afternoon.
You guys get a special lineup at the banks?
We used to until COVID and they shut them all down. And like,
because it used to be a business line at TD, I know yeah. that. And you get to skip the whole
yeah,
scenario. Now,
Airdrie,
nobody
the,
has it.
Yeah, the Airdrie, the TD had a business line. We'd
yeah.
go there. When COVID came, they got rid of that and they never revived it.
That's
terrible. Bastards.
Yeah. I know. I love that business line.
So, hot tip, with all that said, busiest days generally for closings are the end of the month and the first of the month, right?
Yeah.
So if you're working with a buyer and they have the flexibility, it doesn't matter, and you want a smooth closing.
Mid-month.
Or
like a little off, like yeah, second like
the
week.
Second last. How about the third last day of the month?
You know what? Yeah. I mean, the thing is that people like to move at the end of the
sure.
month. But yes,
if that you could have that flexibility.
Now, you remember, like, so we're getting all this done for a purchase. We've got to get done by noon. Then we got to get the sale. Okay. Now, add on to that at 10 o'clock in the morning, you get a phone call. Oh, my client just did a walkthrough.
I was going to ask you about that.
There's a crack through, you know, here and there. We want to hold back $200. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So, you know, so here I'm on the phone calling up, you know, our friends over at.
We did this recently, Rick. Yeah. Recently, it was like a few hundred bucks, and it was like the most terrible thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it comes with the job. We don't like it because not to sound like.
So what happens?
But you remember, we're only getting paid a few hundred bucks for these deals. If I got to spend all freaking morning trying to figure out, you know, that somebody took the drapes, right? Where are the drapes? Or, you know.
So if you've already sent the money, what happens after that? If they decide to agree on, it's hold back.
I'll find you at Walmart buying drapes.
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is there's no good remedy. So what your legal remedy is, you just take a possession of the property.
Yeah.
You find that there's a crack in the tub,
you
know, and you want to get it fixed. Or the house is filthy, dirty,
right.
And, you know, whatever. So your legal remedy is you have to close the deal because it's not a substantial enough, you know, the property has to be substantially the same condition as when you saw it.
Yeah, let's talk about that substantialness.
But substantial is really substantial.
Yeah.
Like, it's a real big problem.
They left garbage in the garage. Yeah, doesn't count.
Yeah, nobody cares about that. And, the client cares.
Yeah.
I mean, but the thing is, like, your legal remedy is you have to close the deal.
Lawyers don't care. Agents don't care.
Yeah.
Just the client. Just the buyer.
So the buyer has to close. And you can't just, the buyer's lawyer can't just unilaterally hold money back. Because if we go back to what I said before, this is all done on the trust letter, which is undertakings and promises between lawyers. I promise you that you can use this transfer of land if you promise me you will send me the money, right? So the buyer's lawyer has to send the money. He doesn't have a choice. If my client calls me up and says, listen, hold back 10 grand, I'm not happy about this.
You can't.
I can't. What I can do.
My pinky swore. I can't.
What I can do and what I do is I will call the seller's lawyer and I will say, this is a problem. What do you think we can do about it? You know, can your guy get in there to fix it or can we agree on an amount of money? And then he's got to go to his client and say, listen, they discovered this problem. Would you give them $500 for it? Right. Or will you come in and fix it? Right. And that is all just negotiation because, you know, in this city in Calgary, and Airdrie's kind of part of Calgary, you know, the real estate bar isn't that big. If I'm dealing with another lawyer on a deal, I'm probably going to deal with him again. Yeah.
It's like agents, same thing.
Yeah.
So the thing is, if I get a call from another lawyer and he tells me, hey, I got a problem. My client has discovered an issue. Are you going to do anything about it? If I told him just go pound sand, well, I can bet the next time I'm not going to be treated so well.
Right.
My client. So we always do try to resolve. Mm-hmm. And you know what? We almost always do succeed. Mm-hmm. The odd time we just can't. And then you just tell your clients, well, you got to close the deal and then you can sue in provincial court.
Right.
In small claims. And that does happen, but not usually.
Right.
When you think about the hundreds of deals that you do, very few go to litigation. I'm not in business to litigate. I used to litigate years ago. I don't like it. I'm here just to do happy law, make people happy, you know, buy houses, sell houses. You know?
So, one of the things I wanted to ask is, or comment on and ask your thoughts, realtors, as you know, we're not lawyers. And I'm sure over the years you've seen some real doozies in the additional terms where realtors are adding terms. So there's probably some pretty funny ones you could tell us. But one of the things that is very common practice for agents is to address issues that were discovered, say, at a home inspection, something that needs to be fixed. You do an amendment, add an additional term. And oftentimes the protection for that buyer, if you're representing a buyer, is to include a holdback in that term. Yeah. And if it's properly written with a release mechanism and everything, that is, and that's fine. But oftentimes it's not properly written. And we're seeing a growing trend of lenders actually not wanting to see holdbacks at all on contracts. So do you have any advice to agents on how to write them? And if you're allowed to write them, if the lender will go for it, and if not, how are you supposed to protect buyers to make sure those issues are addressed?
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked it because these do cause us headaches. Okay. So first of all, pretty much all lenders, they don't want to see it.
Yeah.
Right. If there's a chance, if you say, oh, listen, we're going to hold back $3,000 until these things are done. And I can see why you want to do that because, you know, you're trying to protect your client. But if you look at it, the lender's point of view, if the lender sees that, they say, if there's a chance that you're going to be paying $3,000 less for this house than what you originally told us, then we got to recalculate your mortgage, right? It's not a problem until you're close to that 80% or that 95%. Mm. Okay, so if you're buying a house, a typical house now is like 500 grand, if you can believe it. It sounds crazy. But okay, so if you have in your contract, hey, listen, we found a bunch of problems. We want you to fix this, 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 and that. And we're going to hold back $5,000 until that's done. That means as far as when the bank looks at, when a lender looks at that, they're going to say, well, if there's a chance it doesn't get done, then this purchase price is not $500,000. It's $495,000. Now, if your client was intending to finance 95% of that purchase price, that $5,000 makes a big difference. And now he's not going to get his, the bank will, first of all, on closing day, say, nope, we're not funding when we know that there's a holdback and the holdback's not going to be released or something. They're going to say, we have to recalculate this mortgage. So they will recalculate. They will say, okay, we were going to lend you, $475,000. Not anymore. Now we're only going to lend you $473,000, you know,
right,
whatever. And you have to remember, people are usually on their last nickel when they're buying their house. And they...
Well, and it takes time to recalculate.
They can't They can't come up with another $3,000, right? So, and for us lawyers, it's a pain in the kazoo because we just received new mortgage instructions. We've already had the client in last week to sign the mortgage. Now we have to redo it all over again and get the clients to come in again, right? So we don't like them. Now, if you're going to do that, number one, it's probably a good idea to talk to the lawyer. I'd be happy to give advice on how to write those things to do the best possible because it's just going to save me a headache later. Okay. Number two, you have to be very clear about what the terms are. Okay. So we're going to hold back $5,000. Okay. For how long?
Mm-hmm.
Right. What happens if some of the work gets done and some doesn't? Who's going to decide how much money gets released to fix the things, right? Are we going to hold back at all? Who determines? You might put in there, well, they have to clean this and send us a receipt for a professional cleaners, okay? That's probably pretty easy to do. But you got to make sure that it's easy to determine whether or not the holdback should be released. And then how long will you keep it? So you really should say, listen, if it's not done by closing, we're releasing the money. Or if it's not done within 10 days or something, we're going to hold back the money for 10 days. If it's still not done 10 days after closing, the money gets released. So you got to make sure those are very clear on who's deciding, how do you determine whether or not the work's done? And whether it's done properly, you know, that's another thing. Okay. and then how are you going to determine when to release it and how are you going to deal with that? If someone's financing like 70% of the value of the property, it's not a problem. That doesn't matter. It's when you're right at that 80% threshold and you don't want to go into CMHC land, or you're at the 95%, you know, threshold, that's where it's going to be a big problem. And then I just have one last thing to say on those is my experience is if you ask the seller to clean something or to fix something, I can almost guarantee you when the buyer comes in, they're not going to be happy with it. That's not clean enough. That's not done properly.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So now, as far as for me, I think the best way to deal with it would be to say, let's just change the price.
Yeah.
Like, we'll fix it ourselves when we get possession. Instead of paying you $500,000, we're going to pay you $495,000. So let's just do an amendment to the price. Then that's no problem. And the buyer doesn't have to worry about whether he's satisfied with how the seller does it, because they never are. And we don't, and we can submit that amendment to the mortgage broker, and they're going to make sure that we're financed for $495,000 and not for $500,000. That's the best way of doing it. Having said that, I understand life is life. You know what? When I buy a house, I don't want to have to go in there and start fixing things, and I don't have any skills, right? So they got to hire somebody else. You know, like I'm not your handyman kind of guy. So I understand why people don't want to fix it themselves. But you know, the easiest way is just say, listen, there's about $5,000 worth of work here. Let's change the price.
But why would the bank think about it that way though? Because if there was something that house is still worth $500,000, but there were some things that needed to be fixed. So when those things are fixed, it's worth $500,000. Doesn't make it worth less.
Yeah, I agree with you, but you have to remember, and that's how we used to deal with those things.
Right.
But it's getting worse because you have to remember the banks are always fighting against fraud.
Yeah, and that's right? That's an easy way to get an extra $10,000.
Yeah. So if you change that around, play with those figures a bit. Oh, we're going to give you a credit for this, and on closing, we'll write you a check back for, you know, $6,000 or something. That's an easy way of getting your house with no down payment.
But you know, at one point, the bankers were the one that was telling us to write holdbacks and had to be attributed to something that had needed to be fixed and all that stuff. Like that came from banks.
Came from banks,
and they were okay with that, and mortgage brokers and things, and then. Yeah. You know, down the line, they're like, oh, we don't like that anymore.
It's a common sense thing. Like what you're saying is, listen, yeah, if we do the work and get it fixed, then it's worth $500,000.
Right.
But you have to remember that banks have been burned so many times.
Yeah.
Right? That they just.
Poor banks.
And sure they have. Do you remember when that big litigation came out? Oh, God, 10, 15 years ago. You know, when all these brokers, realtors were getting sued, you know, these straw buyers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of those defendants were realtors. A lot of those defendants were bankers.
Yeah.
A lot of those defendants were brokers. Some of those defendants were lawyers, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the banks are just getting gun shy. They, you know, we can still get away with it sometimes if it's properly worded, you know, but for the most part,
I think smaller amounts help too, like $500 holdbacks.
Yeah. You know, back when houses, you could buy a house for $180,000, you know, you could, we're going to do this and that, and here's $5,000 there. These people are buying houses for no money down.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the same thing that happened with the whole, assumable mortgage thing. You know, it used to be that you could buy a house just to take over the mortgage. You didn't have to qualify for anything, right?
Yeah.
And those are the days.
You know. Yeah,
good old days.
But it got abused so badly that, you know, it was just ridiculous.
We hope you enjoyed that episode of the Hennessy Box Podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on these great conversations.